Okay, thank you. It's a great pleasure to be here. I'm now at Princeton University, and I'm interested in a number of topics in transient astronomy, going from explosion mechanism, stellar mergers, modeling of observations, stellar dynamics, and other things. So today I would like to tell you about the work that we've done with Jose Prieto and Thomas Muller from Chile that concerns with trying to estimate explosion properties of normal hydrogen-rich core collapse supernovae. The fundamental question that came up several times during this meeting is the mapping between the properties of massive stars, such as their initial mass and metallicity, and the outcomes of their lives, a supernova. This plot here summarizes one example of a theory that connects these two quantities that we've produced with Todd Thompson. This plot shows three possible outcomes: successful explosion leaving behind a neutron star, explosion with significant fallback, and a failed explosion that doesn't produce a supernova. This is as a function of initial mass and metallicity. This plot has also been shown here before, mostly from works of others that have obtained similar results using a variety of approaches, going from more analytic to more numerical to what we found. The most striking thing about this plot is that the success and failure of core collapse is intertwined in a very complex pattern in a rugged landscape that is not a simple function of the initial mass. Now, one of the points of my talk today is that no matter what the theory connecting massive stars and supernovae is, it has to be eventually tested by comparison with observations. So the question is, how do we do that? Given all of this fine structure here, I think the implication of this plot is that we need to consider not only individual objects, but we need to reproduce the properties of supernovae as a population as a whole and compare this with observations. So how do we do that? The detection of gravitational waves or neutrinos from core collapse would be exciting, but I don't hope to see one during my lifetime. So there might be other things. Direct detections of supernova. Sorry?
I'm more optimistic and I'm older.
Yeah, I have a negative mind. Direct detections of supernova progenitors have already provided interesting results. For example, the red supergiant problem, the lack of explosions in this mass range could be explained by a type of theory that I'm showing here. However, the number of these progenitors is relatively small, and I propose there is another way to test a theory like this or any theory that is similar. This plot shows outcomes, success or failure, depending on these properties. But there are other implications of this diagram in terms of properties, other properties of the explosion, such as explosion energy, nucleosynthetic yields. They're important is nickel 56, properties of the compact remnants. These quantities have distributions and are correlated, and these correlations can have intrinsic scatter. And we can obtain these quantities from observations and compare with theory. I think this is a very good way forward because all of the data that is coming in from transient surveys, which will culminate with LSST, means that it will become easier and easier to obtain more precise answer over time. So how do we do that? How do we obtain parameters of supernovae from their light curves? Here I show a V-band light curve of a prototypical type 2 plateau supernova, which should come from a red supergiant with initial mass less than about 25 solar masses. And you can see that the light curve is divided into two parts. In the first part, the light is diffusing out of optically thick, recombining hydrogen layer, and the luminosity that we observe depends on explosion energy, ejecta mass, progenitor radius, and other parameters. Later on, when this layer becomes transparent, the light that is coming out is due to thermalization of radioactive decay products of certain elements, and the favorite element here is nickel 56. By measuring the normalization of this exponential decay, we can estimate the mass of nickel that was synthesized. Now, this light curve at least the first part of the light curve has basically three features: the luminosity of the plateau, its duration, and we can also measure velocity. So we have three observables, and we can try to determine three physical parameters out of this. By employing analytical scalings, one can come up with a relation that gives explosion energy, ejecta mass, progenitor radius as a function of plateau duration, luminosity, and the velocity, expansion velocity, that is measured spectroscopically. What you can see here is that the coefficients in front of these quantities are quite worrisome. For explosion energy and ejecta mass, they are identical here and very similar here. This means that we cannot uniquely identify explosion energy and ejecta mass based on these properties. The vectors in the three-dimensional space of the observables are nearly parallel. This means that we need to take great care in determining uncertainties and covariances of various parameters when we are trying to do this. The usual way of obtaining parameters is that we take observations and we correct them using for reddening by adopting some reddening value, adopting some distance, manually constructing volumetric luminosity, etc. However, this introduces uncertainty that in the process that is not defined in any way. So what we propose to do instead is to construct a global, complete, self-consistent, hierarchical, and phenomenological model of light curves in multiple bands and expansion velocities. In this way, all of the uncertainties and covariances within this problem are exposed through a gigantic covariance matrix. What we are essentially trying to do is that we are building template light curves in many bands and template expansion velocities using a global version of the expanding photosphere method, which is again a version of Bade-Wesseling. So here is an equation that describes in more detail what we do. A magnitude observed in filter I at time t is given by a combination of things that don't change in time, some zero point, distance modulus, reddening and reddening law, and then components that change in time. Expansion of the photospheric radius, which is wavelength, which affects the light curve in a wavelength independent way and is determined by the expansion velocities. And then the SED of the supernova changes as a function of time. There is a certain SED evolutionary sequence that all type 2 plateau supernovae go through. And each supernova starts at a different point and goes with a different pace through this SED evolutionary sequence. To give you a more general view of this picture, we have certain physical quantities, photospheric radius, effective temperature, and we have observations, and the thing that connects these two quantities is some kind of transfer function. Within our model, this transfer function is completely data-driven, determined just from the observations. If we had perfect knowledge of radiative transfer, opacities, etc., we wouldn't need this intermediate step. But we don't know this, and we can use the wealth of the data that is available and that is coming to determine this function. We trained this model on a sample of 26 well-observed supernovae that are nearby. We have a few thousand magnitude measurements in about 20 bands going from UV to near-infrared. We have a few hundred expansion velocities, and the model overall has about 400 free parameters. However, not all of these parameters are equal. There are certain global parameters that affect all supernovae, such as the magnitude zero point reddening law and the description of this SED evolutionary sequence. There are parameters that affect only individual supernovae, such as distance modulus, reddening, and the parameters of the evolution. This splits the problem in many smaller subproblems that can be tackled in a much simpler way. So here I'm showing an example result of the fit of supernova 99EM for bands going from U to K, and we have the fits for many other supernovae. You can download the tool from my website and you can try to apply it to your own data. So when we have this, what do we find? First, we have this complete SED evolutionary sequence of type 2 plateau supernovae. We can plot it directly, as is shown here, and The advantage here is that because it's a global model, we can utilize the similarity between individual supernovae to sort of predict what the flux should be in the bands that are not directly observed. This allows for a better bolometric corrections and other things like this. We also have a complete description of all of the light curves given some coefficients of the fit. We can manipulate these coefficients to give us interesting products. So I'm showing here bolometric correction as a function of B minus V, which basically illustrates this SED evolutionary sequence that we determined just from the data. This was obtained just by manipulating the coefficients without no manual labor. We can produce these bolometric corrections for any combination of two filters that we have in our sample quite easily. We, of course, can easily produce uncertainties of these things at any point. We can also address the question of diversity of normal hydrogen-rich supernovae. These two plots show fits to light curves of 80K and 14G, which are traditionally classified as type 2 linear supernovae. The fits for these two cases are pretty good, which indicates that they go through the same SED sequence as normal type 2 plateau supernovae, which indicates the similarity. However, the slope of the plateau is different, which points to different evolution of radius and temperature as a function of time, and that points to different structure of the progenitor of these stars. Now we can use the information of the whole sample of supernovae to try to constrain some of the physical theories. I'm showing here a well-known correlation between the nickel mass determined from the second part of the light curve and the plateau luminosity. That's the first part of the light curve, which depends primarily on the explosion energy. Each point is a supernova in our sample. Here, I'm plotting the uncertainties in the traditional way, independent in X and Y, and you would argue that these data points are compatible with a single line with no intrinsic spread. However, when we propagate the uncertainties correctly, including all of the whole covariance matrix that we have from the fit, you can see that the confidence ellipsoids are extremely narrow and very elongated. The reason for this is that the primary source of uncertainty here is the distance uncertainty. We can essentially move the whole bolometric curve up and down within the range of distance uncertainty. You can see here that these confidence ellipsoids are elongated along the same direction, that's because of this distance uncertainty, but this direction almost coincides with the direction of this correlation. This makes me extremely worried that some of these correlations might not be real. In this case, however, the dynamic range of the data that is observed is sufficient to claim that this correlation actually exists in nature. It gets more complicated with other quantities. So here I'm showing two quantities of interest to core collapse supernova theory. This is nickel mass, an explosion energy obtained from the analytic scaling relations. The observations are shown with the gray ellipsoids, and again, the ellipsoids are elongated because of the distance degeneracy. And the points shown here are results from our work on the neutrino mechanism and progenitor structure that combines these two things to give these predictions. You can see that the correlation is roughly explained from this model. There is also similar level of internal scatter to this relation, which is important and comes from differences in the internal structure of the various progenitors. However, there is this systematic offset, which comes either from improper calibration of the data or the theory or both, and more work is needed here. Finally, I would like to show a correlation between other two quantities of interest to theory. This is the explosion energy and this is the ejecta mass, which is very similar to the mass of the progenitor. And you can see that again, there is a sign of some correlation, but this correlation has a direction that is again very similar to the elongation of the confidence ellipsoids. And the reason for this is this degeneracy between explosion energy and ejecta mass that I mentioned in the beginning. There might be also sample selection effects in this case, and it might be that the correlation doesn't exist, that if more data are obtained, the data would fill this parameter space more evenly. So I think that's an interesting open question for future investigations in this field. Finally, I would like to address the question of how we can move forward with all of the data that is coming to us from PTF, Assassin, and eventually from LSST. LSST will discover approximately 100,000 core collapse supernovae every year, and most of these supernovae will have magnitude measurements in few bands every few days, and a spectrum will be obtained for some of them, probably not more than one spectrum. So in order to learn more about supernovae using this data, we need to focus primarily on techniques that operate on photometric data that try to extract these parameters primarily from photometry. For this, I propose that there is a very good way forward by combining the phenomenological approach that I just presented with a more physical approach. We can add additional layer to the problem that I was showing that is based on physics. Assuming some parameters that are physical, such as explosion energy, ejecta mass, nickel mass, metallicity of the progenitor, etc., we can use some kind of physical code to calculate quantities such as photospheric radius, effective temperature as a function of time. Then we have again this intermediate layer that is data-driven and that allows us to translate these physical quantities into observed magnitudes in individual bands and to fully constrain this model and to do the fitting. So what can we learn? If we have enough data, we can address questions such as how do supernova properties change as a function of star formation rate, galaxy type, age of the universe, etc. This is exciting, but there still remain certain things that cannot be avoided, such as the degeneracy between explosion energy and ejecta mass. To illustrate this in a more physical model, I'm showing here logarithmic derivatives of luminosity with respect to explosion energy, mass of the envelope, mass of the nickel, and explosion time. But of most importance is the explosion energy and envelope mass. You can see that the black and red curve are nearly a mirror of each other with opposite signs. That means that if we simultaneously increase explosion energy and ejecta mass, we get very similar bolometric light curve in the end, and we also have nearly the same specific energy, which gives the observed velocity. However, these two curves are not exactly identical. There are some small scale features that could be utilized, if properly understood, to break this degeneracy and hopefully reduce the uncertainties and covariances in explosion energy and ejecta mass. There are now already efforts ongoing that try to provide more realistic uncertainties to these quantities from physical models, such as this work by Morozova et al. 2017. There are potentially other complications to this modeling, and one of the complications is circumstellar matter that can be located close to the progenitor and affect the early light curve. Recently, there has been a lot of attention on supernova 13FS from flash spectroscopy and modeling of the light curve. And here is a fit that we obtained to the data on this supernova, and you can see that at early parts of the light curve, the fit doesn't work. This is a clear indication that there is something different, that this supernova at early parts is not part of this universal SED evolutionary sequence. And if we can somehow utilize this property, we could detect these supernovae and place limits on the amount of material that is around them in some automatic way. So I think now I ran out of time, so I will just leave my conclusions right here. Take questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much. The question, comments, please. Norbert?
Don't need to be the...
Norbert. Yeah, that's really great stuff. So it seems you are able to tell us what the structure of type 2 linear supernova models really is. So why don't you tell us?
within our model, we parameterize sort of the evolution of the photospheric radius as a function of time. But in order to turn this into density profile of the progenitor, we would actually need to do some physics rather than phenomenological modeling.
I would have thought you would get at least the ejecta mass, envelope mass, global properties from your approach.
Oh yeah. So we can get that. And let me see if I can go back to this plot. So A decay is definitely on this plot. It's a matter of figuring out which color is it. So yeah, A decay is this brownish thing, and now we need to go here. So I would say it's lying somewhere here, maybe here. Yep.
So with the, the previous plot, when you look at the ejecta masses as for the different individual supernovae, yep. Have you compared the ejecta masses in cases where there's actually a progenitor detected, and is there some agreement if you allow there to be a neutron star?
Yeah. So I talked about with Stephen Smart about that, and that was actually the original plan for doing this work, and I completely forgot why I didn't do this. So that's a thing that should be done very soon.
I have a question about your light curve modeling. Maybe I'm on the completely wrong track and just asked the wrong question. The light curve fits, which I had seen to some data, what do you assume about the mixing? Is it relevant? I mean, when you want to get good light curve fits, as far as I know, it's important how far out you mix nickel and how much that spreads over the energy release over the plateau is also of relevance. So, how much uncertainty do you have in that?
It's a phenomenological model. There is nothing like this is in there. It's a phenomenological.
Can you then rely on the parameters you get out?
The parameters are good, as good as the scaling relations are. But obviously, if we transition to a more physical model, we could include things like efficiency of mixing here and get posterior probability distributions of that from the modeling.
I presume your mass is basically the hydrogen envelope mass.
Yeah.
And there's no clear reason why the envelope mass ejected and the explosion energy should be correlated.
Yes.
Because the former is very much a measure of mass loss, and the latter has got to do with things around the iron core.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, even if it was correlated, I don't think the explosion mechanism requires that there is correlation between these two quantities. So I think that's why it's very important to determine whether this correlation exists and how exactly do the data look like.
Jim?
So for the 2Ps, it seems to me there's maybe another parameter you could extract from the data, which is the duration of the fall from the plateau to the nickel decay. Have you thought about trying to do that? I know it'd be a hard thing to measure, but what would that tell you if you could systematically measure that?
Yeah. So actually, this duration of the transition phase is one of the phenomenological parameters.
Oh, it is.
That's
it's already in there. Okay.
And, you know,
I missed it. Sorry.
Yes. I mean, I didn't mention this explicitly, but of course, with O5CS, it's extremely short, and in some other supernovae, it's very long. And I think that relates to a talk by Paul. That will be the next.
So it does tell you something physical.
Yeah.
Okay. Paul will tell us.
Hopefully.
The other plot I always show when I give a talk about your work is the radius plot, because you do have a number for the radius of the explosion.
Yeah.
You chose not to show it.
Yeah. It seemed that the radius was very similar for all of the supernovae. So I was interested in the explosion mechanism, and there the radius is not not that interesting, I would say.
But you don't have it to show.
No, I'd have to find the email to you that I sent to you. a few hundred solar radii. But I mean, it's dependent on this analytic scaling relation, so it's only good as the analytic scaling is.
Ring?
So do you plan to do the you applied all this machine to type 1C, or other types besides 2P, 2L?
So this method is basically based on Bode Wesseling and expanding photosphere. So it, in the incarnation that we have, it only works for things that have well-defined photosphere. So that's type 2 plateaus and type 2Ls, and we did a similar work on Cepheids, which are pulsating stars. For other types of supernovae, you'd have to abandon this assumption that you have a well-defined photosphere and do something more general. And I mean, for 1As, people have done various kinds of templates, and this framework could potentially be adapted to 1Cs, 1Bs, and other supernovae.
Lovely stuff. I'm enjoying using your data.
It's my data.
Well, peace. It's from you that I'm using. It mumbled. Yes. expansion velocities. How you up at the top, you say spectrum rarely, and at the bottom, you say you're going to be using expansion velocity. So are you going to be able to get adequate expansion velocities of a few per light curve or what?
Yeah, so, I mean, that's sort of not up to me how many spectra will there be. And so the expansion velocities are there primarily to fix the distance. So that's very important for measuring or estimating the distance to the supernova. So if we knew the distance, I think we could do very well without any velocities at all. And the model, in principle, is not degenerate even with zero velocities and unknown distance. But of course, the uncertainty, if the data are not perfect, is gigantic. The distance module is uncertain by 10 magnitudes or things like this.
I've seen cases like
I'm trying to model some of this data. And I can get cases where I can get absolutely gorgeous fit to the light curves, and the velocities are just garbage. And I have to go back and work really, really, really hard to find something where I'm fitting both velocities and the light curve. So I think you're fooling yourself if you think that you've got a fit to the light curve and you're done.
Yeah, well, so that's also the advantage of this data-driven transfer function. So yeah, so you can measure expansion velocities on,
yeah.
So you can measure expansion velocities on various elements, which will give different numbers. And if you include this within such a function, you can sort of bring everything on the same scale. Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah.
Can you show the transfer function? Do you have it? What does it look like?
Oh, yeah. It's I think about 60 parameter function.
Okay.
So it's not easily visualized.
Okay.
Is it publicly available?
Yeah. You can download the fitting tool from my website, which includes the coefficients for the function.
Okay. Tomas again.
Yeah, just a comment once again on this light curve, because I know, heard that you are interested in this decline. The decline phase is particularly sensitive to the mixing. There's a paper coming very soon from our group where we show that what you have in the mixing is really affecting your decline. The second question is on this tension which you had with the production of nickel and I think it was explosion energy where you saw the theoretical points lying a little off the maybe it's this recipe which you use for initiating the explosions. Yeah, it's not the same in Bernhard's or in our calculations.
Yeah, it's something different. I actually made this plot after these two papers were published. So actually, the two quantities are independent in the way that I work on it. So I was surprised that it matches, because our theory didn't match with previous results by Hamui from 2003. The slope was very different. But I mean, I agree. I mean, the prescription in our model is very primitive.
Okay. Any more questions? If not, let's thank Andre again.